Extreme winds from the weekend will die down today before another windy pattern comes in Tuesday. In between, wildfire danger is staying high. On Insight, the latest on wildfires, weather, and power outages. I'll talk to people from CAL FIRE, the California Office of Emergency Services, and the National Weather Service. Over the weekend, CAP Radio's Randall White talked with Governor Gavin Newsom. You can find that interview and much more emergency news and information at capradio.org. Politico's political writer Carla Marinucci will join us from the Bay Area. She was supposed to be in a power shutoff area over the weekend, so she'll have a couple stories to tell. We'll talk about the California congressional delegation, including Katie Hill. At the end of the hour, mystery writer Katrina McPherson joins us. She, too, might have been in a power shutoff this weekend in Davis. It's all ahead today on Insight. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. Sunday was a day of chasing new fires as well as the advancing existing fires. Today, the winds are calming across the northern part of the state. If you've been outside, you have instant proof of that. But the wildfires in some places are still growing. CAL FIRE is about to do its daily briefing, which usually happens at 7 a.m. It is happening today at 9 a.m., and so our guests are on standby. We are expecting to bring you the latest information from CAL FIRE and the Office of Emergency Services Chief of Fire and Rescue. So for this moment, because we're talking about the winds and the changing picture, let's join Michelle Mead, meteorologist from the National Weather Service, and get some updated weather information. Hi, Michelle. Glad you could be with us today.
Hi, Beth. How are you doing?
Well, I think today everybody's breathing a bit of a sigh of relief, at least from the winds. So what is the forecast today, both for the Sacramento Valley area, and then take me to the west, too, in the area of the Kincade Fire?
So, like you mentioned, we've definitely seen a decrease in the winds. We did have some bruises overnight, but those are also coming down quite a bit, and that will continue through the rest of the day. So the headlines for fire weather concerns are going to expire here at 11 o'clock for all areas. And then we're going to get a 24-hour break. And unfortunately, we are seeing another wind event. Another weak wave is going to come down and increase the winds yet again from the north and northeast. So through the Delta and across the Kincade Fire from early morning tomorrow through midday Wednesday. So we're not out of the woods yet for the winds because we do still have very dry conditions across the area. Now, the winds for tomorrow are not going to be as strong as we saw over the weekend, but they are going to be very similar to what we saw last Wednesday.
Can you verify the description of hurricane-level winds over the weekend, and then what mileage are you looking at in this event tomorrow and Wednesday?
So to be categorized at hurricane level one, you need a gust of 75 miles an hour, and we did have a few of those in the coastal range and then up in the Sierra. Those have calmed down quite a bit. The event we're looking at for tomorrow into Wednesday, it's going to be more sustained 20 to 30 miles an hour with gusts 35 to 50. So it's not quite the hurricane 75 mile an hour wind, but still 50 mile an hour is definitely strong enough to keep those fires burning pretty actively.
Michelle, this is wind event on top of wind event. What kind of extended forecast are you able to talk about with any reliability at this point?
So the good news is after Wednesday's event, it does look like we're going to be continued dry, but the winds look like they're going to calm down a little bit. The ridge off the west coast is going to build over western California a little bit, which will decrease the chances of seeing these inside sliders. That's what's been bringing us all these wind events. And when the ridge moves over the state, it kind of pushes all those winds into Nevada and further east. What that does mean is temperatures are going to warm back up above average. So while we'll be pretty chilly for the rest of this week, by next weekend and early next week, we'll be back up near 80. And average this time of year for the valley is in the mid-70s, low to mid-70s. So we're not quite out of the heat yet. But the dry conditions, unfortunately, will prevail. So Again, we're going to keep messaging, you know, it's still dry out there. So even though we don't have strong winds, we're still under a fire threat just because things are so dry. But the winds that really carry the fire are not going to be as strong in the next 5 days after Wednesday.
All right, Michelle, there's some good news in that message. I appreciate you joining us.
You're welcome.
That is Michelle Mead, meteorologist from the National Weather Service office in Sacramento, now on the phone from the California Office of Emergency Services, Chief of Fire and Rescue, Brian Marshall. Hi, Brian. Glad to have you with us today.
Good morning.
I know the briefing is happening now, but tell me what the priority is right now and focus, if you would, on the Kincade Fire.
Well, the Kincade Fire, OES Fire and Rescue, continues to support with moving fire engines and firefighters to that incident. And because of the entire statewide fire warning and watch that we're under, we have reached out to other states to get additional resources here in California. And 75 fire engines arrived in California from Oregon yesterday afternoon and last night, and they were dispatched to the Kincade Fire and other fires that were breaking in Northern California.
I'm just getting a bit of an update from the briefing that now 4,000 firefighters, as you're describing, additional engines are coming in. Can you tell me what happened overnight that the containment dropped back to only 5%?
Well, as the fire continues to grow exponentially, the control lines that are in place, the control percentage actually shrinks because the fire is outgrowing the containment.
Okay. And in terms of overall size, what happened to the Kincade Fire yesterday?
Well, the Kincade Fire continues to be dominated by the severe weather condition that we're in. And wind pushes fire, obviously uphill, downhill, and it's very hard to work that fire aircraft. It's difficult to fly. The fire is moving faster than we can keep up with it in the operational sense. So these wind-driven wildland fires are extremely difficult to control.
Chief, what can you add to this picture about PG&E's plans and their update on this overlap of perhaps beginning to restore power in some areas, but not getting to that point by the time another wind event starts up late tomorrow?
Well, from the fire and rescue side here at the Office of Emergency Services, we're working with local government fire departments as these power shutoff events occur. You have to remember the power shutoffs are due to a weather event, and it's extreme fire conditions that could happen should a fire start. So we are augmenting local government fire departments throughout the state that are being affected by the power shutoffs by putting extra fire engines in the communities to provide surge capacity should a fire start.
Is this related to the governor's declaration of a state of emergency across the state, or does the response and available resources not happen quite that quickly?
Actually, it happened prior to the governor's declaration. We monitor the weather, and when weather conditions become extreme, we augment local government fire departments with additional resources. So we are out in front of the event. These additional resources are responding at surge capacity when new fires start, and it gives us a better opportunity to control these fires before they become major disasters.
Can you add to what extent there's mobilization happening in the South? We're hearing this morning about this new fire along the 405 in the area of the Getty Museum. Can you address what's happening in Southern California?
So this new fire broke out early this morning. We immediately began mobilizing resources, that's local government and Office of Emergency Services fire engines, to the incident. These augmented strike teams, these pre-positioned strike teams, we had four of those responding early on. And each of these strike teams has five engines in it. So that was four times five. That was 20 fire engines immediately that would have had to be mobilized, and there would have been a longer response time. They were on the front lines. We also have mobilized other fire departments throughout Southern California and six more strike teams. So that was 30 more engines. So we continue to mobilize fire engines and firefighters to that fire to provide support to the Los Angeles City Fire Department. And they're on the ground working right now, and more orders are being processed to support that major incident.
Can you give me any context, Chief, for how different what you just described might be from, for example, let's go back to 2017, and I'm trying to get a sense of whether the volume and the pace of response has changed dramatically in these last couple years of firestorm activity.
Well, the Office of Emergency Services received $25 million to pre-position resources in communities that had severe fire weather predicted. So we are providing a surge capacity to get more fire engines and firefighters on scene quickly in an area that's been identified with severe fire weather. So that augments our initial attack resources. It just puts more firefighters on the ground, more fire engines to protect structures. And the goal is to contain these fires when they're small. So we're putting additional resources and personnel in the communities to better protect them.
Is that new money and higher in this 2019 fire season than it was over the last 2 years?
We actually received the money in the last fiscal year, and we began the process of pre-positioning resources. What we've seen this year in conjunction with the power shutoffs, because the power shutoffs are driven by severe weather. So the severe weather that is impacting all of California right now, we're putting more and more resources out there. And today we have 17 of these active pre-position resources out in the state. And that's over 100 fire engines and the firefighters that staff them that are additional. They're over and above using this pre-position funding.
All right, Brian, I just got an update from PG&E, so I think I'll say thank you and let everybody know what PG&E is saying about the weather all clear. And again, I appreciate you just stepping out of that briefing to join us today on Insight.
Thank you very much.
And that is from the California Office of Emergency Services, Chief of Fire and Rescue, Brian Marshall. PG&E's statement is that the weather all clear has been issued for this latest public safety power shutoff event. 6,000 team members are conducting inspections on equipment and working as quickly as possible, PG&E says, to make repairs where needed and restore power. PG&E says it's monitoring the weather and defining the scope for a potential, again, public service power shutoff event for October 29th, for later this week, as those winds are expected to surge again. Now let's get CAL FIRE's Deputy Director, Chief Mike Moeller, on the phone with us. Hi, Chief. Thanks to you, too, for stepping out of the briefing and joining us right away on the air.
Yes, Beth, as always, thank you for having us.
I'd like your take also on what happened overnight, that now on the Kincade Fire, there are two fronts, I understand, both in Sonoma County and Napa County, where the battle is happening and there have been evacuations in Napa County.
That's correct. So we still experience those extreme fire conditions, as you mentioned earlier in the show. The actual containment number lessened. Now we're over 66,000 acres. This fire is actually the direct protection area of CAL FIRE with our management team. And what we're seeing is those red flag conditions are actually continuing. We saw a lull in the wind event, but again, we still have a lot of open fire line. Additional resources have been ordered, but it's definitely something that we are following and monitoring.
Chief, at one point I saw there was a projected date of containment on the Kincaid Fire for November 7th, which is interesting because the campfire started last year on November 8th. Is that November 7th date off the table now?
You know, when we look at a containment date, we use the term cautiously optimistic. It depends on, again, weather conditions. What we're going to see is another wind event come in the middle, latter part of this week. That's something that we put that is a date that we can move. But right now, as the containment lessens and we see this explosive fire growth, that's probably a date that can get pushed out.
Will you talk a bit about Contra Costa County? It seemed that two, three fires erupted at the same time. They were frightening to people, but I'm understanding that maybe they're for the most part under control now.
That's correct. And what we're calling that is a complex in that county. And again, a local government partner of ours and CAL FIRE responded to those three fires. We feel comfortable with those fires. The most important part of that, Beth, is those fires have actually been wind tested, meaning that we've had a significant wind event around those containment lines. They have not expanded. So we're comfortable with those. But still, anytime we have fire, open fire line, it's still a risk. It's still a caution that we take very seriously.
Will you describe the erratic fire behavior that happened this weekend during this extreme wind event?
So, we've talked about this, but it's not the new normal. This is the normal. What we see is explosive fire conditions. What we're seeing now is the spotting, the embers carrying a half mile to a mile ahead of it. Firefighters are actually, what we do on this is we do a tech called flanking the fire. We cannot get in front of it. We have to try to steer it to the lesser areas of population. But again, explosive fire growth like we've seen in the past 5 years is that unfortunately the state is impacted from border to border.
We should focus on 101 in the West. And over the weekend, there were preemptive evacuations in a part of the county that you might not think fire would become an issue of. 101 has been a border. I understand no fires west of 101 for decades and decades. Can you talk to me about some of the decision making in that part of the state? And also, Chief, how we are in a different era of decision making.
And unfortunately, what we've seen, even with the fire yesterday in Vallejo, you know, people think that because of what we get the onshore, the marine layer every day, and that it's, you know, right up against a body of water, that they're not susceptible to these type of fire conditions. As we saw several fires yesterday that were right on the coastline, that is not true. So operationally, I can tell you CAL FIRE, the state fire agency, are working with our local government partners is to remind every agency that through training and communication response that any area of the state is, it's not if, it's when it's going to be impacted by a wildfire. But in most importantly is that the community and the public sees exactly what is going on and to be prepared, because as we saw, unfortunately, in Coffee Park, the Tubbs Fire, which the Kincaid Fire is burning into some of that footprint, is you may think that you're not in the traditional wildland-urban interface, meaning brush up to the back of your home. You can be in what you would consider a suburban area and be impacted by wildfire. And unfortunately, what we're seeing along the coastline is a precursor to what we see statewide.
All right, Chief Mueller, one more question. The governor over the weekend in his press briefing said, quote, there is a plan to get out of this. This is not the new normal. And he was referring to PG&E and the power shutoffs. What latitude does CAL FIRE or the CAL OES, for that matter, have when PG&E is able to make its decisions about power shutoffs completely independently? Can you tell me what happens from inside this network of agencies?
Yes. In fact, as you know, Governor Newsom, his administration, from the day he came into office, has leaned forward in fire protection, forest health and management, prevention. In fact, his second day in office, having the press conference at our Colfax Fire Station, is we are walking lockstep with the governor, his administration, Office of Emergency Services, Cal Fire, local government, to look at the power companies and how they are shutting off power. What your listeners need to remember is that we never preemptively ask for them to shut down power in any area unless it's directly affected by an ongoing incident. So what we will do under the governor's direction, the California Public Utilities Commission, is work to see how, like the governor said, let's clarify for us, when I say new normal and normal, I'm talking about vegetation conditions, climate change. Governor's talking, directly about the impacts of these PSPSs. So our due diligence is to work with the administration to review, are these PSPSs actually preventing wildfires, and get that data back to the governor so we can look at working with the utilities to see where is this as a very advanced state. Is this something that has to be done? Is this something we need to do? But is to come out of this with a better opportunity and a better solution than what's happening now.
All right. Well, Chief Brian Marshall called us being under surge capacity right now, and I think that that's an echo being used across all the network of emergency response agencies. Anything to add to this? And then I'll thank you and let you get back to your next meeting.
No, Beth, as always, thank you for, supporting us. We've done these interviews several times now, and now you add that extra layer of the public safety power shutoffs to the communities. And really, it's about public service for all of our agencies, getting people out of harm's way. And again, by the governor's statement, as far as what we're doing, we need to look harder, faster in how this works, and a better opportunity to remedy this solution.
Chief Moeller, thanks as always for your time.
Thank you.
That was CAL FIRE's Deputy Director, Chief Mike Moeller. Stay with capradio.org for continuing coverage. Now, one more report on the wind, the fires, and the power outages. I'm glad that Danielle's been standing by. This is Danielle Vinton from KQED. And Danielle, I believe you're in Petaluma. Is that correct?
That's right. Yes, I live in Petaluma.
So you've been out reporting for several days. Tell me a little bit about where you've been and what you've seen happening around you.
Yeah, so I first heard about the fire on Wednesday night, and I got up really early Thursday morning and was driving around Geyserville at about 5:30 in the morning. And the winds were very strong, really sort of hurricane force winds. And what was striking driving up on Highway 101 was how close the fire looked. It was really hard to tell kind of exactly where it was located because the lengths of flame were just enormous, and it looked like it could be, you know, really close even when it was still, many miles away. When I got to Geyserville, the flames were coming down the hills, approaching the valley. Like I said, you know, the winds were really strong, and I got out of there. I didn't feel safe sticking around. Since then, I've been at the temporary CAL FIRE headquarters in Santa Rosa, speaking with some friends and family who have evacuated, and some fire meteorologists talking about their work.
Say something about that and the difficulty in predicting fire behavior, which may not even be a correct term at all.
Right. Yeah. I mean, fire modeling is a really complex science. It's useful because the scientists can give firefighters and fire officials some idea of the potential rate of spread. But it's by no means a perfect science. You know, it has to incorporate temperature, humidity, terrain, fuel conditions, and the winds, which are really difficult to model on a fine scale. During these wind-driven fires, one of the major dangers of spread is due to spotting, which is when these firebrands, a piece of wood or a leaf on fire can be flung by these winds hundreds of feet, even up to a mile or more. And scientists cannot predict that spotting behavior very well right now. I did speak with some researchers yesterday from San Jose State University, and they're starting to work on that question, which I thought was really interesting. They have this new tool, which is a very precise radar mounted on the back of a pickup truck, so they can drive it to fires and use it to peer inside of the smoke plume. So they're starting to get a look at what the inside of a plume looks like and the particles that are blowing around in there that create these firebrands. And they're hoping that it's still early days, but eventually this may make it easier to get a handle on how these spot fires start and where they're likely to spread.
Well, it's hard when you're in the midst of an event to allow yourself to step back and look at the big picture, but so many people are focused on prevention and data gathering so that sooner rather than later we can turn the tide on knowing more. And it is a fascinating science, isn't it?
It is. It is. You know, and at Keep Community Science, we've also done a lot of reporting on steps that we know work to lessen the risk of catastrophic fires. So things like hardening homes, creating defensible space, controlled burns. And I think that in the coming, you know, in the coming months, after all of this, after this crisis period dies down, you know, I think there'll be a lot of attention on talking about, you know, what can we do in the future to lessen the risk of catastrophic fire.
Danielle, thank you so much. Be safe out there. I appreciate your time today on Insight.
My pleasure.
That's Danielle Vinton, a science reporter from KQED. And again, stay with CAP Radio's continuing coverage. Up next, Politico's political reporter Carla Marinucci will join us. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. Here in the West, President Trump was live early Sunday morning detailing the killing of ISIS's leader. Democratic leaders in Washington had not been notified, apparently, about the raid, so that's a major political headline as this week begins. The other being the resignation of Katie Hill, who represents California's 25th district. Reporter Carla Marinucci.
I've been.
She writes Politico's California Playbook. How are you, Carla?
Hey, good to be with you.
So you were in a potential power shutoff area going into the weekend in the Bay Area. What happened where you were?
Yeah, we were. And we've been out of power now for about 36 hours, I think it has been so far. This is the second time we were out the first time as well. You know, smoke is hanging over the Oakland Hills. A very wide swath of the East Bay is without power. So, yes, the folks on our Politico team, all of them were affected by this power outage. So we've had to scramble this morning to get out our California playbook at 6 a.m. when it normally does. It means getting out there in the complete black and trying to find some place that's open that has Wi-Fi. It's just an example of, you know, if it's frustrating for us, multiply that by 2.2 million people in California, and you're getting a picture of what the political implications of yet another shutdown is.
What creatively did you do? Because I know you need a laptop, you need to charge your cell phone.
That's right. There's no Wi-Fi, no cell, no nothing in the Oakland Hills. There's no communications. What I had to do the last time was head out and look for a place open at 3:30 in the morning to start filing. And, of course, Starbucks isn't open at that time. I actually ended up on the floor of a 24-hour fitness filing my playbook. And that's the kind of thing our staff had to do this morning as well. This is a real dilemma, and it really kind of shows it's just one little story. But so many Californians are dealing with no childcare, no schools. Restaurants, everything closed. This just shows why Governor Gavin Newsom is, you know, all over this, saying it is not the new normal. And we talked to Jerry Brown this weekend, who said, "Oh yes, it is the new normal." So,
right. Well,
example of the political challenges ahead.
Let's start with the current governor, and he's declared the statewide emergency. Already in the show, we've talked a little bit about the movement of resources, but what options does the governor really have in this situation?
I mean, he understands That if people think this is going to be a regular occurrence, this is going to weigh very heavily on him. He's mentioned several times in the last couple of days that he has been here just 9 months, not 9 years, not 19 years. But the fact is, the buck stops with him, and he knows it. So he has been saying, we will not bail out PG&E. He told our Angela Hart that yesterday, that accountability is where he's at on this. And he has been very, very hard in his message on PG&E that there is a plan to get out of this. This is not a 10-year process. He says that will not be the case, and that California is going to demand something radically different than what was done in the past with PG&E. What are his options at this point? I mean, you've got some cities, Sam Liccardo being one of them in San Jose, are already talking about a public takeover of utilities. Jerry Brown says that is a very complex and very hard way to go, and that officials may not understand how complex that is. So right now, Gavin Newsom's options are, I mean, he's got to get them. First of all, he's got to get control of the situation. He does seem to have that. He was all over the North Bay yesterday, getting out his message that Californians can get help and trying to calm the fears. But we're already being told that there are more shutoffs possibly due later this week. This is a political nightmare for Gavin Newsom, and there's not much he can do about the weather aspect of it. So he has to work and to control the anger against PG&E and demand PG&E come up with some solutions.
PG&E, in fact, talking about that next round of power shutoffs being as early as tomorrow evening. When you talk about calming fears, then you go to former Governor Jerry Brown's words. I'm going to quote from the Politico playbook. This is only a taste of the horror and terror that will occur in coming decades if officials in Washington don't deal with climate change. And in fact, the former governor's on his way to Washington this week, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. He's going to be testifying before Congress on this. And, you know, Jerry Brown has said for a long time that this is the new normal. And what we're seeing in California is only a harbinger of what's going to occur around the globe in Africa, in Canada, in Latin America. He says that this is something, of course, the Trump administration has not dealt with, has denied, and that Congress has been unable to mobilize. He is being very, very strong in his words. He's not kind of sparing anything. And he absolutely publicly disagrees with Gavin Newsom about this being the new normal and says that it is time for elected officials to get serious and to stop, dancing around what is the very dangerous scenario that looms just in a couple of years, not only here in California. So I think it was very, very interesting to sit down and talk with him this weekend. But he is talking about PG&E and he as well, and says, look, this is a very complex thing, and a takeover of PG&E, that's one of the things that has been talked about. That may be politically untenable. That may be turned into higher gas prices and other issues. So he says that it's time to look at this from a non-ideological point of view, that cities should not be rushing to take over the power business. They have to understand fully what the new normal is and deal with the issues of climate change, then get to issues like perhaps undergrounding. And that is an issue about that people like Loretta Lynch, the former PUC president, have brought up, saying, look, California is taking a $2 billion hit every time these, economically speaking, every time these outages occur, that maybe undergrounding has been considered way too expensive in the past, but maybe now this is the time to actually sit down and deal with it.
Hmm. Well, the hearing that the former governor is headed to has an interesting name, Trump's Wrong Turn on Clean Cars.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm talking with Carla Marinucci. She writes Politico's California Playbook. I was going to shift to the congressional delegation reacting to the news that they didn't know about this ISIS leader raid happening. But let's jump first to the Katie Hill story. John Myers is tweeting this morning, you might know this as well, Carla, that Assemblywoman Christy Smith has announced a campaign for the seat that Representative Katie Hill says that she is going to resign from. I think this has been a surprising and still unfolding story for a lot of people in California and across the country.
Yeah, I mean, we broke that last night about Christy Smith jumping in. And look, she won't be the last one to jump in on this one. This is the California 25th Congressional District. Katie Hill was already facing a crowded field in that race even before this horrendous story broke last week, when she was the subject of a piece on a conservative website, Red State, that sort of opened this whole story up. It has been a nightmare for her, and I think it's been a nightmare for Democrats. A flow of embarrassing and defamatory reports that have basically popped up, accusing her of having a sexual relationship with her legislative director, Graham Kelly, and then also with a campaign staffer. She has denied that relationship with Kelly, but look, the fact is, some incredibly damaging photos got out there. And even though Katie Hill was considered a rising star in the Democratic Party since she was elected in 2018, she was part of that blue wave, Beth, and Nancy Pelosi immediately tapped her to be a vice chair on oversight, which is right in the middle of the impeachment issues. That was a plum assignment. So she was on her way up when this happened. She was very close to her congressional district. She did town hall meetings. She was considered a really good example of what a freshman congressperson does. And yet this story erupted and it just blew up a career that she's not even been in office a year.
She has said that it was her husband, whom she is in divorce proceedings with, who released the photos, that he was trying to humiliate her. I think the story will go on, but it will change once she has stepped out of office and her political career has ended. We don't have a date for that at this point, do we?
No, we do not. There are some people that are pushing back on her and saying that she shouldn't resign. We've heard from Equality California, the head of Equality California, which is a major LGBTQ advocacy group in California, and Rick Zurbs. He has said, look, she should keep fighting, that people are behind her. They're on one hand, a lot of people feel like this is a double standard when you have Donald Trump accused by multiple women of sexual harassment, when you have Duncan Hunter being accused of having multiple affairs while in office, yet neither of them have been touched, and yet Katie Hill pressured to resign. On the other hand, you've got an issue that the Democrats are dealing with. They have an impeachment issue going on in Washington, and the distraction of being asked every day about these salacious reports, I imagine. Nancy Pelosi has been very tough on sexual harassment. That put them in a bind. This story basically handed incredible amount of ammunition to folks like Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham on Fox News, and they were already starting to be all over it. And so as Democrats were dealing with impeachment and some very serious stuff, the Katie Hill story was a problem for them. And this was the first time that such allegations have involved a female lawmaker, Beth. That was the other issue. And so Democrats were being put under scrutiny as to whether they applied the same standards to a woman as to a man. And, you know, with Al Franken, with John Conyers having to resign on sexual harassment issues, a lot of people were looking at this to see if the same ruler would be applied to Katie Hill. So this is a traumatic thing for the Democrats, and Republicans are watching it very closely. But boy, already that congressional district has a crowd of people looking to take over Hill's seat. This is going to be interesting to watch.
All right, I can't have you bring up Nancy Pelosi's name and not address the fact that she and Adam Schiff, other Democratic leaders, were not told about this remarkable raid and then the event of the killing of the ISIS leader over the weekend and then the fallout from that. So I know you're writing about that story as well. Where do we go from here on that one?
I mean, this just shows the political divide that we're at in Washington when the president of the United States essentially says he trusted the Russians more than he trusted the Speaker of the House and Adam Schiff, the head of House Intelligence, to handle this information. This is a complete departure where presidents in the past have dealt with terrorism in a bipartisan fashion, in the sense that Republicans and Democrats stood together in Washington against any threat from the outside. But President Trump made it clear that he didn't see it that way. And Nancy Pelosi told reporters that this is just unheard of, that the House must be briefed on a raid like this. So this is part of oversight. This is part of their job in advance of a critical issue like this that involves national security. So I don't think we've heard the end of it, and we haven't really heard the president. I haven't been asked or pressed on this action that he actually gave more warning to the Russians, the Turks, and the Syrians, apparently, than he did to his own, leaders in Congress. I think that's an issue that has yet to be fully explored and just shows the divide and how deeply it has grown in Washington.
Well, he was emphatic in his live address Sunday morning in talking about the leaders of the other countries and the long list of countries. At the point of that address, we didn't know that he hadn't notified Democratic leaders. So that puts his remarks and the emphasis on the world communication that was happening in a much different light, knowing he hadn't brought in everyone in the Washington inner circle.
That's right. And to suggest, as he did, he said Washington is a leaking machine, essentially disregarding his own congressional leaders on this very critical raid, and saying he doesn't trust Americans to uphold American values or to protect Americans here on an issue like terrorism. I think it's a very significant thing, and I think we haven't really heard the end of where this will go. Does this mean he will no longer inform Congress and the Democratic leaders in Congress of major security issues? I think he needs to be pressed on that question.
Yeah, I think that is the question. What is next? All right, Carla, thank you so much. Good luck getting power back, although depending on where you are, sounds like it could be days. It could be late this week.
We'll survive, we hope. Anyway,
you need to take a page from Jerry Brown and Ann Gust Brown. Didn't he say that they have solar collectors and lithium ion batteries?
Yes, he said we don't have to worry about PG&E. We're totally off the grid. So, maybe it's time for all of us to go there.
All right. Well, thanks again. Thanks for your time and your reports, Carla.
Okay, good to be with you. Thanks.
That is Carla Marinucci. She writes Politico's California Playbook. We've posted a link to her latest playbook writing at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Cap Radio. This is Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. Let's finish this hour with something other than power outages and wildfires, sort of. In the studio with me is the award-winning mystery writer Katrina McPherson, who lives in Davis. And in fact, Davis has experienced power shutoffs at different times. I don't know what unfolded this weekend, but hi, Katrina. How are you?
I'm very well.
Davis has had rough weather, has its own power situation, but you've been caught in a little bit of it, haven't you?
Yeah, we were out for 20 hours on the 6th. six, was it the six at the start of the month there? And then we had that surprise half hour of darkness on Saturday when we were just about to go to the steakhouse in Winters for my mother's birthday and everything went dark. And then it all came back, which made the steak extra delicious.
Well, so. Happy birthday to Mom, too. Are you prepared? Do you have a standby generator? Or what
we haven't got a generator, but we're prepared now. We've got lots of lamps and water because we've got a well, so we've got no water when the power goes out, and a camp stove. And Neil, my husband, went out and bought Spam. For some reason, he just went straight back to being a scout on a hillside somewhere. So we've got tins of Spam.
It's so funny. You write these detective novels, the Dandy Gilbert series, back to the 1930s.
Yeah,
and in some ways, life is throwing us back to time, 100 years ago.
Yeah, we've got the big bucket of toilet flushing water. That's what makes me feel slightly hard done by, I'm afraid.
You have a couple books being released at the same time.
I know, not by choice.
One is a standalone mystery, two in the Dandy Gilbert series, and you just said not by choice. How did this all happen?
Oh, well, completely separate publishers. So one's Minotaur and one's Quercus, and they put them into their schedules, and here we go. They're 2 weeks apart. I mean, I'm happy, but I'm not sure I would have done exactly this.
What is your writing pace? What's typical for you in a year?
Three books a year, so 2,000 words a day, 5 days a week. In theory, every 10 weeks there should be a first draft. And then I've got a big edit coming. I tried to do, for a book that's coming out next year, I tried to do something structurally quite adventurous for me. And I've got a huge edit to do now, but I'll do it.
What about losing power? Are you a longhand writer at all, or are you completely gadget dependent?
I am gadget dependent, but one time when I had a broken arm, I wrote in with ink in a notebook. So I just charge up, and then I was at the edge of the outage, so we could just go to, I think we went to Vacaville and charged everything. There were lots of people with cables in Panda Express in Vacaville.
Where we gather, right?
Yes.
Where we gather. I am a fan, as you know, of your standalone mysteries. I think you're able to pull some of the most unique inspiration and weave them into some very scary stories sometime. Let's talk about Strangers at the Gate.
Oh, yes, it is. It's pretty dark. I mean, it's literally dark. It's set in a very narrow, deep valley with no sunlight in the winter. And it takes place over a week in the winter when a young woman is dragged. I just thought of this in the green room. She's dragged away from where she's always lived by her husband for his job.
Well, hello. Does that sound familiar?
But only about 40 miles. And things look too good to be true. He gets a wonderful job. She gets a wonderful job. They get a free gate lodge cottage, and the things are looking too good to be true for the usual reason.
Maybe that was an unfair joke toward your husband, because he did pull you across the pond, as they say, and then across the country to come to Davis from... Your birth home was?
Scotland, yeah.
Edinburgh. But the little town.
Oh, Queensferry. Queensferry, mm-hmm. yeah. Yeah, I know. I mean, being dragged to California is a bit different from being dragged down to this dark valley where bodies pile up.
You wrote a happy character in this book. You have a really good person and a happy family.
I did, yes. I wrote a happy marriage and a functional family. I wrote a close, happy, loving family. And a good person. Finny Lamb is a good person. It was quite a surprise. There are lots of other people as well, but I did it. Yeah.
So that book came out October 22nd. Again, it's Strangers at the Gate, like all the others. I really love your standalone mysteries. But there are two Dandy Gilbert's, number 13 and number 14. Number 13 is being released on the day of a book event that you have coming up.
Yes, on the Tuesday, the 5th of November, A Step So Grave is being released in the US, and I'm going to Capital Books on Quay at 6 p.m. that night to celebrate it.
That bookstore is right next to the Crest Theater.
Yes.
For people who know downtown Sacramento. It's just been open about 6 months. Lovely little bookstore. So that opening is happening. Meanwhile, your next Andy Gilver, the 14th book in the series, won't have its U.S. debut for a while, but it is coming out soon in the U.K.
It's coming out in the U.K. Yeah, things are not quite in step. But then, given how flustered I get when two books come out at the same time, I'm kind of glad things are not absolutely in step. It's a bit of breathing space.
The Agatha mystery-style story of Dandy Gilver and the character herself, it's evolved a little bit over the 13, 14 books.
Yes, she has. It was quite bright to the point of brittle. It was very mannered, I think, to start with. I mean, I'm still fond of those books, but they were just puzzles with some archetypical characters in them. And now, as we get closer to the Second World War and as the relationships deepen, I think it's more shaded. I think. Yeah. Although there are still funny bits in them.
The book that's coming out later is called the Turning Tide book. And the one that's being released on the 5th is
A Step So Grave, set at a wedding. In the build-up to a wedding, which
great
is a lovely structure.
For yeah. the setting of the book. Can you say anything about the big edit that you have and what's coming?
Yes, it's for a book which is another standalone, and it's a book that I'm calling A Gingerbread House. I don't know if the publishers will let me call it that, but I love that title. And everybody who's heard it so far said, yeah, possibly. And it's got lots of narrators. It's got four different narrators, which I don't usually do. I usually climb into one person's head and stay there. So that's what's pushed me slightly beyond my comfort zone. And I just need to do a bit of a spit and polish on it.
So Katrina McPherson giving all of you a choice of books, or you can get an armful all at once. She will be at Capitol Books next to the Crest Theater in downtown Sacramento on November 5th at 6 p.m. There's much more on our website. Some great photos, too, on the website that were inspiring
you.
To the books. Thank you. This was a short conversation, but I appreciate you being here on a day that's filled with a lot of other tougher news.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, and thank you for what you're doing about that tougher news.
All right, be safe.
Thank you.
That is, again, Katrina McPherson, and that's Insight for today. There's much more coming throughout the week. I'm Beth Ruyak. Thanks for joining us.